This is an ABC podcast.
Fear not, beloved listeners, there is hope. And I refer to the issue of climate change, where we all feel pretty hopeless and helpless. But tonight, you're going to meet a young climate scientist who has written a book called Humanity's Moment, a climate scientist's case for hope. And it's got at least a scintilla of good news. But first, time to talk to Dana Morse. Dana is the ABC political reporter for Indigenous Affairs. She's a Punga man and a Parawa woman and joins me on The Blower from Melbourne. Welcome back, Dana.
Hate to correct you off the bat, but I am in Canberra tonight. But oh, lovely to be with you. Yes.
God, you're peripatetic.
Now, poetic, poetic and chic.
Dana, I have to admit, I have no idea who Shekel O'Neill is, but I understand he's caused a bit of bother. Can you explain?
Well, you're not the only one who has no idea. I mean, my own mother calls him Shaneel or whatever, but it's Shekel O'Neill. And for the unindoctrinated into NBA in America, he is a basketball player. He retired about 10 years ago, and he's one of the all-time greats and has gone on to have a really illustrious career post-basketball in the media, on talk shows, and has had a lot of different really memorable commercial partnerships as well.
And why is he in our news?
Well, he met with the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, and the Indigenous Affairs Minister, Linda Burney, over the weekend. And it was just, quite honestly, bizarre. Those were the thoughts I had when I saw the alert from the Prime Minister's office, because it's really just a more odd combination than anyone really could have thought of. The Prime Minister's office said that Shekel O'Neill reached out because he wanted to discuss the voice to Parliament, which in itself is odd. He hasn't been to Australia in 20 years. And when he gets here, I'm guessing, you know, he's logged on to abc.net.au and he's been reading one of our fantastic articles on The Voice, and he wants to lend his hand to it, I suppose. What happened was he came into this press conference and he sort of, you know, wandered onto the stage, said a few things. He loves Australia, anything you need, Shaq's here. And then he wandered off. We didn't even get to ask him any questions. And the questions would have been interesting had we had the chance.
But isn't, don't we welcome all offers when we try to drum up the yes vote?
Well, yes. And no, because the government hasn't really launched its PR strategy around the Yes campaign. So to go for this as your very first sort of foray into the marketing campaign is really odd, and it's landed really off with a lot of people in the Indigenous community. Obviously, in a country like Australia, there's a lot of people who are just obsessed with sport. So getting something like a sports ambassador totally makes sense. But we have so many homegrown stars and Indigenous ones too that have skin in the game that you would think would be the first port of call. I mean, I'm thinking Patty Mills, Kathy Freeman, Eddie Betts, because they actually sort of can relate to the discussion that's going on. And then when you put this in context, it's all happened without a clear strategy from the government about what they're going to do with this yes vote. We don't have detail that they've been calling for. I mean, they say the details out there. They say there's a 500-page report. I say that's not good enough personally, because that report was commissioned under a former government. It's 2 years old. Significant flaws have been pointed out. We have no indication if they're going to fix them. So they just sort of, they really put the cart before the horse on this one. They didn't think about how this was going to land. And I mean, as an outsider watching this, I've got questions. I want to know who reached out to who. They're saying Shaq reached out to the PM. Is it that he couldn't turn it down. Is the PM such a big fan of Shaquille O'Neal that he was like, yeah, absolutely, we'll do a meeting. If you want to come talk about The Voice, that's great. Like, I want to know the behind the scenes on this, because it hasn't worked the way they thought it was going to. Everyone's just talking about what on earth was Shaq doing, and no one's talking about The Voice.
It's interesting because the criticism comes from across the spectrum. Jacinta Price couldn't do it, and Lydia Thorpe.
Yeah, they both had things to say. I mean, Lydia Thorpe was more irritated with Shaq himself saying, you know, as a black man, you should have known to come into this country and pay respect, not to come and talk over us. And Jacinta's saying that it just shows that the government is completely out of touch with the community if they thought this was a good idea. I mean, there is some form in the past where American sports stars during the Black Power movement would come to Australia and they'd go to places like Redfern and they'd meet with Indigenous leaders and elders. And those were really powerful moments. And I just think, how much better would that have been if we'd had Shaq at Redfern talking to mob and you know, joining forces with them, rather than this absolutely bizarre and bungled media appearance that has just completely sucked the air out of the debate?
I'm talking to the dynamic Dana Morse. The Jobs and Skills Summit underway in Canberra. Earlier this week, there was a symposium of Indigenous workers, employers, academics, unionists. What came out of that meeting, Dana?
Well, they are wanting to put Indigenous employment on the agenda as part of the Jobs and Skills Summit. And here in Canberra, we've honestly talked of nothing else for weeks. We, you know, it's like Christmas Eve. We can't wait for this thing to kick off. So we need to understand what they're saying from this symposium is there need to be a better understanding that Indigenous workers are employed across all areas of the workforce, and there needs to be broad-based policies in place to support their experience. They want to see better workplace inclusion, better data, and for employers to be getting the ball rolling on things like cultural agreements. And what we know about the Indigenous employment experience is that there's this really problematic, grateful mindset where employers think an Indigenous person is just grateful to have a job. They don't think about their aspirations or a career pathway. And that just tends to trap people into entry-level jobs that they're not necessarily passionate about or feel like they're getting any fulfillment out of. And they're passed over for advancement and promotions. And you can see people leave the workforce for that reason. And the lack of aspirational pathways can discourage people from getting into work in the first place. They don't want to be stuck in an entry-level job, and that can be a roadblock to getting into paid work.
You looked at a report put out by the Jumbunna Institute. Tell us what their findings were.
Yeah, they had a lot of really interesting things come out in this report. And I'll read you some stats to start off with. So 38% of Indigenous workers reported being treated unfairly because of their backgrounds. 44% reported hearing racial slurs at work. And 59% reported comments about the way that they should look as an Indigenous person. And one of the other things that this report sort of brought up was the idea of a high cultural load and identity strain.
Explain what you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. They're kind of, you know, these jargony terms, but what it boils down to is, as an Indigenous person in the workforce, a lot of the time we're the only one there. We're the only black fella in the room. And so we're the person that everybody goes to on everything Indigenous all the time. And you're expected to be this sort of oracle and authority on things like, you know, NAIDOC Week and Reconciliation Week. And with all the chat about The Voice lately, I mean, I can only imagine what it must be like to be working in a corporate environment or something and standing around the water cooler and having people say, what's going on with The Voice? What do you think about The Voice? You don't just get to come to work and exist. You have to perform your Aboriginality to people all the time. And it's just exhausting.
And also on the list were little issues like, you don't look Indigenous.
Yeah, yeah. So that's like a form of a racial slur, I would say. I mean, I've got personal experience with that one. It's comes in the form of you don't look Indigenous or how Indigenous are you or, you know, like it can be really insulting and invalidating and make you feel like you don't get to claim your own identity because you're in this sort of white space and the rules are really different.
Okay, 63% experienced high identity strain. What does that mean?
So identity strain is a word that we use when we're describing what it's like to be butting up against a white workplace and being an Aboriginal person or a person of any sort of diverse background. So it's where the two things don't interconnect. You know, you've got to do things like code switching where the way that you would talk or the way that you behave outside of the workplace isn't acceptable or you can be judged on it because you're Aboriginal and you're, you know, acting in a certain way. So you are almost putting on a mask every time you come into work and it can feel like you are betraying yourself, betraying your values and your identity in order to work in a white workspace or, you know, feed the capitalist machine. So it can be lead to burnout for a lot of Indigenous people because it's like you are living two lives and a lot of people, you know, good on them, they're brave and they're strong and they come out and they don't code switch. They don't have that identity strain. They are authentically themselves in all spaces. But a lot of people struggle with this and it can be really problematic for workers.
The community development program will likely be replaced. The main issues with it were?
Well, this problem has been plagued for a long, long time. So basically how it works was people were expected to go to 4 hours of work-like activity per day in order to get their employment benefits. And then what happened was, you know, you're going 25 hours a week to receive welfare, which is about 3 times longer than city-based job seekers. And this program disproportionately captures Indigenous people because it operates in remote parts of the country. The other thing with it was, you know, if you were late or didn't turn up for an activity, you'd be fined. And so it was this sort of punitive, you know, system where people are on welfare because they need money to live. And then, you know, they would be not turning up to an activity, possibly for a good reason, like a cultural activity, you know, sorry business, that type of thing. Maybe they were just sick. Maybe they just couldn't get there in time. And then they'd be fined some of their payment for that.
Outrageous. Now, finally, I understand there's a meeting recently of all the state Indigenous ministers in discussing how state legislation is going to work with any constitutional changes at the federal level. The states are approaching reconciliation differently, for example.
Yeah, so alongside all these discussions about the voice at a federal level, there's also truth and treaty processes that have to be carried out both nationally and at a state level. And the ball's already been rolling in places like Victoria. Queensland have recently announced they're going to do a 3-year truth-telling commission. The Northern Territory have got plans in the works, so does Tasmania. And now it's a negotiation about one can't cancel out the other. So the government hasn't decided, the federal government hasn't decided what they're going to do around truth and treaty. They know they're going to do it. It's called a Makarrata Commission. It's coming, it's in the pipeline, but they're not 100% sure on it yet. Whereas we've got states like Victoria where the truth-telling process has been going for over a year. Treaty negotiations are going to start next year. And a couple of weeks ago in the state parliament, the Treaty Authority Bill passed and that created the treaty umpire that's totally independent and funded outside of government reach. So that's going to be happening from next year and it has to fit in with the federal process. So they're just having these conversations to make sure that when the Victorian Treaty goes through, for example, that it isn't then overridden by a national treaty. So it's going to be a very delicate puzzle to put together.
So in a sense, Victoria is cutting edge in Australia.
Absolutely. I mean, I know a lot of Victorians. I live part-time in Victoria. They like to think of themselves on the cutting edge of everything, but particularly, you know, they've got props for Indigenous affairs. They've done a lot of work to get to the process and the point where they are. And it's, you know, really interesting to see that a state is leading the national process here and, you know, that the federal government is looking at what Victoria is doing and learning from that and going, yeah, we'll take that element. We won't do this, but we'll do that.
Dana, finally, any expectations yet on when the referendum will be held?
Well, I know that the Prime Minister was on a radio program earlier this week and he said it won't be in the first half of next year. We've all been anticipating that it will be in 2023 because if it goes to 2024, it'll be sliding into an election year and it'll be very difficult to get it done. So we are anticipating that it'll be next year and now the second half of next year. But it's tricky. They got to get the pacing right on this. They can't afford to go too quickly and have the public not know enough. And they also can't afford to wait too long and run out of steam. So second half of next year is all we've got for now.
Good on you, Dana. Dana Morse, ABC Federal Reporter, specialising in Indigenous issues. And Dana is from the Pandamarua Parawa mob. And coming up, a chat with the brilliant climate scientist and communicator, Joelle Gerges, who shares the hope that she retains for the planet. You might have noticed, beloved listeners, we've already had two brilliant women scientists on the program, Elise Bryce on soils and Toby Kears on fungi. And tonight we welcome a third. Dr. Joelle Gerges is a climate scientist and writer at the ANU. She's a lead author for the IPCC's sixth assessment report and yet has found time to write two books and numerous articles, not just about the science, but about how a scientist responds to the research and communicates it to the world. Her first book, Sunburnt Country, The History and Future of Climate Change in Australia. Her latest, which we're about to discuss, is called Humanity's Moment, A Climate Scientist's Case for Hope. Now, I've been banging on about climate change since it was known as the greenhouse effect for about 40 years. So I'm delighted to be talking to someone who feels some hope for the future, because God knows it's been a depressing subject. So welcome with your hope to the Little Wireless program.
Thanks, Philip. It's so nice to be here.
Joelle, before we get into the science, tell me about your background. I understand you were born, or your father was born in Egypt.
Yeah, so I have an Egyptian heritage. I was actually born in Dublin. And my family migrated to Australia in 1977. I grew up here, but I guess I have that sort of sense of understanding the vulnerabilities of the developing world. And I think that's something that I've really taken with me in my career as a scientist, as I've progressed and really gone deeper and deeper into science.
Now, your parents were passionate believers in the power of education.
Yeah, my dad was really amazing. He was someone that he was one of seven children. He grew up on the outskirts of Cairo, and his family went broke during the Great Depression, and he really didn't have enough money even to do very much, actually. And he couldn't afford to pay for the university exams that they used to charge a fee for that. And he had to climb the fence and hop over there and do the exams. And he basically really built himself up and eventually left Egypt, and we ended up in Australia some years later.
We're going to be talking a lot about tipping points in this discussion, but for you, a tipping point was the 1994 fires.
Yeah, I was young and I was at school, and I remember seeing these ferocious fires really bear down on bushland not too far from where I lived, and I started to think about, well, what is it that causes this variability in the Australian climate? And just seeing all of those ash falling in our neighbourhood and burnt leaves, and it really made me want to understand, well, what is actually going on here? Why is Australia so ferocious like that?
And you did your PhD on?
El Niño. Yeah, so I actually reconstructed a history of El Niño events. It's the largest source of year-to-year climate variability on the planet. And so it was an opportunity to get a sense of what those natural cycles are like that cause a lot of droughts and floods in different parts of the world.
Joelle, give me an idea of the work that was involved in preparing the sixth assessment report released last year.
Yeah, it was absolutely colossal amount of work. We had to sift through thousands of peer-reviewed articles and then condense that down into these really intense chapters. And there were about 13 chapters in the volume that I worked on, and each of those were 80,000 words each. So you're looking at a report of over 1 million words. And it was a really extraordinary process. That report then went out to expert and government review. And all in all, we had to sift through and respond to around 75,000 different reviewer comments, which was quite a huge task, really.
234 scientists across the globe, time spent not paid but volunteered.
Yeah, so all of us were selected based on our contribution to the scientific literature and our expertise. But, yeah, we were all doing this on the background of our day jobs, which for me, I'm a university lecturer as well as a research scientist, and having to get up at all sorts of hours to attend meetings, particularly when COVID shut down our in-person meetings and we had to do everything online, that became really, really difficult. But what really was extraordinary was the altruism of the group of people gathered from all different parts of the world, really working around the clock to produce the most comprehensive climate assessment humanly possible.
Are you working on the seventh report, Joelle?
Oh, Philip, I'm still recovering from the sixth. The seventh will come out probably around 2030. So right now we've just, reports come out every sort of 7 years or so. So we've just got one more volume in this sixth assessment report. And then basically it's really up to the world's governments actually to take forward our recommendations.
So in a sense, you're at another personal tipping point because now you want to focus your work on communication.
Well, I feel like there's really not much more else I can really do as a scientist, I feel, except for share this information really far and wide. I mean, it feels like the most important book I'm ever going to write, because if we think about the carbon budget, we haven't got another 10 years to waste. And so I could write another research paper or teach another university climatology course, but really the most important thing is trying to share that information with the broader community so we can have a think about what we really want to do about this.
You were influenced by one of my all-time heroes in Rachel Carson, the author of Silent Spring, because she taught you it's okay to be emotional about your science.
Absolutely. I mean, she's such an inspiration. She was a real trailblazer. And for someone like me, I think many of us feel a sense of grief around the loss of the natural world and the destabilisation of the planet that we're experiencing at an accelerating rate. But really, when you're a scientist, people expect you just to operate purely from a place of logic and reason, and I certainly do those things in my work. But I also had an emotional response to the material that I was collating as I was working on this UN report. And the other thing that really was unfolding as I was working on this is that Australia went through our Black Summer bushfires, where we saw 25% of Australia's forests burn in a single bushfire season. The koala on the East Coast is now an endangered species. And then we've seen the catastrophic flooding of the East Coast, which we're still recovering from. And so all of this was really playing out in real time. And for me, it was this real intersection of my personal life with my professional life. And I realised that what is the most important thing I can possibly do with my time right now? And it felt like write a book.
How has your work impacted on your personal life?
It's been really difficult, I must say, particularly as an Australian scientist working as all of this material that I actually have been studying my entire adult life is just really coming to life now. So there's nowhere to hide from it. And so there are days where it's really, really difficult when you can see these changes in our ecosystems and in the stability of our societies as a result of a changing climate. It becomes a real existential exploration of what it means to be human at this moment.
Day and night, I understand you suffer from sleeplessness.
Yes, there's absolutely times where I wake up and I can't go back to sleep because I'm thinking about the work that I've exposed myself during the day. This was particularly the case when I was working on the IPCC. Some of that material was really confronting, and certainly when I was writing my book, because that was my way of emotionally processing the book. So alongside the facts and figures, it also has my personal response, which is something I hope that my readers can connect with.
Well, that personal response includes being overwhelmed emotionally when you're hiking.
Yeah. So 2020, I went on my honeymoon and we were in Japan, and I literally just left and Australia was on fire. And as a media spokesperson, I literally had to turn off my phone. I had the BBC World Service and lots of other people trying to contact me for commentary. But I was on my honeymoon, and as I was hiking through the Japanese forest, I just really was struck by how lifeless it is compared to the incredible and extraordinary Australian bush that we have here. And it really just broke me down, and I realised that, you know, the world is really changing in front of our eyes. And I really had a moment, I guess, where I could see my own country from this international perspective and realise that we have this extraordinary part of the planet that we're meant to be caretakers of. And I think that is something that we really need to reconnect with, that, you know, climate change can seem like it's all doom and gloom, but ultimately if you boil it all down, it actually just comes back down to love and the things that we care about.
The remarkably fluent Joelle Gorgas, and now let's talk about the way you've divvied the book up, because I find this quite fascinating and rather beautiful. The head, the heart and the whole.
So the head was really basically an opportunity to talk about the nuts and bolts of where are we at in terms of the climate crisis right now. And so I go through and explain the fundamentals of the Earth in terms of all the different systems, how they interact and how we've altered them in terms of human activity. And so that's really just to give people a grounding of the real take-home messages of the IPCC report. And so that's, but it is one thing to understand something intellectually, and it's another thing to understand it emotionally. And so part two is the heart, which is really looking at the impacts on people and places that we love. It's also thinking about the heartbreak of what it is that we have to lose and what we are losing right now, and what are we prepared to save. And then the whole really brings all of that together to realise that we need to connect our head with our heart. It isn't just this, we don't need to compartmentalise. It's okay to feel distressed about some of this really confronting material, but then as a whole, within yourself, but also within communities, and starting to realise that collectively we have an immense amount of power. This is an incredible moment in human history, and how are we going to show up?
Joelle, we must have done 100 programs on aspects of climate change over the years, but there's a couple of sort of paradoxical truths that I think it's important to communicate. Tell me about warm glacial periods.
So the Earth has gone through ice ages and warm periods throughout our entire history. And so we have these really long-term records in both the sedimentary records and ice core records. And so we actually have had warm periods in the past. But what's really different about this particular period is that since the Industrial Revolution in the late 19th century, we've burnt so much carbon that it's accumulated in the atmosphere, and it's altered the chemistry of the atmosphere and also the way that the atmosphere circulates around the globe. And so the difference between these warm periods, say 2 or 3 million years ago or even further back in time, they're not exactly an analogy for where we are today, because there weren't humans altering the landscape in the same way that we are now. And so what is different about this period is that we have effectively altered the land surface and the atmosphere of the planet in such profound ways that it's really an accumulation of everything that humanity's ever done to exploit the natural world. And that's where we've ended up. So these warm periods are natural and they do happen in the past. But
current warming is more than 7 times faster, and the current increases in CO2 are more than 50 times faster.
Yes, thanks for bringing that out. That's one of the things I mentioned in my book. So we are just accelerating these natural rates of variability just through human activity, which is an extraordinary thing to really come to terms with, that we are a geologic force now on the planet.
You know who'd love your book, and that's our old friend James Lovelock. Why does climate change affect different parts of the globe differently?
That's a good question, because some parts of the world might have ice sheets on them. Other places have tropical rainforests, and some areas are covered in ocean. And in an area like Australia, we are an island that's surrounded by ocean. So we're really influenced by ocean variability in our part of the world. But in the high Arctic, for example, where they have ice sheets, they experience climate differently. So it's just that the planet isn't uniform. We have different land masses, ice sheets, forested areas.
And the urban heat effect.
Yeah, and we also have cities. Exactly. So a lot of people now live in cities. I think about 50% of the world's population now lives in cities. And all those concreted surfaces actually cause an enhanced warming at the local level. So when you think about heat waves, they can be amplified because of the fact that we're now a very much an urbanised society.
We talked a little on the program a few weeks ago about zombie fires. Tell the listener about zombie fires.
So zombie fires are effectively when you start to get fires burning into permafrost areas in the really high Arctic. And that's really a concern because there's basically twice the amount of carbon that's in the atmosphere locked up in permafrost. And so when these areas start to burn, they're called zombie because you can't put them out. And because the temperatures are now becoming warmer and warmer throughout the cool season, which would usually be the freeze season, these are starting to thaw out. And so you're starting to see what they call these zombie fires. And that really is a major concern because it's just yet another sign that the Arctic is shifting in really profound ways, and that has major implications for the global climate.
You talk about polar amplification.
Yeah, that's just a process that effectively says that the concentration of ice in the polar areas acts as a big mirror. And so we get these positive feedback loops. So when we start to see the ice recede, you start to see more solar radiation absorbed up by the ocean, which then in turn melts the ice, and then you get this positive feedback loop. And that's why we tend to see more pronounced warming in places like the Arctic because it's just this sort of natural feedback loop that's as a result of the configuration of ice and land.
There was a news story in the last day or so about glacial melting acceleration and the almost certain outcome being a rise in sea level of 1 foot.
Mm. Yeah, so a real concern for the climate science community is keeping the ice sheets stable. And we find that between about 2 and 3 degrees of warming above pre-industrial level really starts to see instabilities in the Greenland ice sheet and in West Antarctica. And when you lose those, you really are looking at multiple metres of sea level rise.
Okay, let's talk tipping points. The melting of the Arctic sea ice has the potential to be a whopper. What are some of the others?
Another one is the slowdown of an ocean circulation pattern in the North Atlantic, which effectively we'll see parts of Europe start to cool down. So
I'm sorry, slow down a bit on that. Explain the mechanism.
Okay, sure. So effectively what happens is that heat is transferred from the warm tropical areas to the cooler polar areas. And there are these ocean circulation patterns. And one of these major patterns is in the North Atlantic. And when we start to see a lot of ice melting, you start to shut down that transport of warmer water in the North Atlantic. And so what that will do, it will actually cause localised cooling in the Northern Hemisphere, and we'll actually see rainier conditions in the Southern Hemisphere. So this is one of these tipping points that people talk about quite a lot. But another major one is the dieback of the Amazon rainforest, and that's a really important
one. Now, dieback as opposed to the burning.
Well, yes. So we're talking about a fundamental shift in the conditions that the rainforest can either grow in or not. So if the rainforest is warmer than it's been in the past and it starts to be encroached on by human activity, then it can't sustain itself. And so it transitions from being a tropical rainforest into more of a savanna open environment, which doesn't lock up as much carbon. And currently the Amazon is the largest carbon sink on the planet. And it's really, really important that it remains so. But right now we're starting to see parts of the eastern Amazon is actually turning into a carbon source instead of a sink.
Tipping points. Let's look at some political tipping points now. I'm tired of talking about the phenomenon of climate change denialism. But that seems to be coming to an end, a rather reluctant end by its advocates. But don't we see evidence of a tipping point, for example, in the last Australian election?
It is a magnificent example of a social tipping point. As a climate scientist, I cannot tell you how relieved I was to see that play out, honestly, because so much is at stake, and having just worked on this UN report, it couldn't be more important. But it just goes to show that when people actually start to vote for people that reflect their values, that you really can see very real political change. And we're seeing that right now. And I think that that does give me a real sense of hope in terms of realising that people have said enough is enough. We want to change our social values around these things and start to think about a world that is a little bit more inspiring and getting more prepared for the challenges that we face, rather than just sort of putting our head in the sand and doing things the way we've always done them.
Well, someone who put his orange head in the sand was, of course, Donald Trump. And there's also hope in the election of Biden, who, even as we speak, is getting some reasonably strong legislation through.
Absolutely. That's right. I think it's the inflation reduction scheme that they put forward, which is a really big boost to renewable, the rollout of renewable energy in the US. And, you know, we do have good progress being made here in Australia. But the really big thing, the big elephant in the room, is the continued exploitation of our fossil fuel reserves. That has to stop. And that's something that the current government, I think, is going to be the big challenge for this government.
I'll come back to that in a second. But everyone fighting against climate change has got exhausted. And I would have thought that this little tipping point we're describing has energised people again, given them personal hope and collective hope.
Absolutely. I really think that's the case. And I think it also reminds me that as I was writing this book and looking at past social movements, is that this is the human story, is that it's a tug of war for social justice. And these revolutionary moments that we're living through have happened before in the past. And I think the climate movement that's happening right now is really just the latest in a long line of these really important struggles for humanity to really rise to this challenge. And I think for me, there's a lot of hope in that, because it makes me realise that there's something very immortal, really, in the human spirit that wants to better our situation. And collectively, when we do act together from a place of value, from a place of shared values, that really anything is possible, and eventually it becomes inevitable.
Denialism was made tougher by the black summer of 2019, and of course the floods that followed have changed the tone of the discussion here in Australia. Where do you live?
When I'm not teaching in Canberra, I live in northern New South Wales. My husband's from Lismore. And these floods that just played out in February and March have just been absolutely devastating to the community. We've still got family that are displaced. They haven't got anywhere to go. Whether to build, rebuild businesses is still a question for many, many people up there. And so for me, it's been very, very difficult to watch, because I realise that if I didn't know it already, but of course I do understand this as a climate scientist, but climate change is happening right now, and it's impacting the people and places we love.
And of course Australia is more vulnerable to climate change than some other countries.
Absolutely. I mean, we're a nation that is really exposed to the vagaries of the weather, because we're surrounded by the ocean. There's just such high variability in terms of, we are the land of drought and flooding rains, and that is a result of
coming back to your PhD.
That's right, exactly. And it does all connect because really we are, it is an extraordinary country, but we are really vulnerable, because as we've seen just in these last few years, we can go from crippling drought into torrential rains. And unfortunately, that is the pattern that we expect for a country like Australia as the planet continues to warm.
Of course, the Northern Hemisphere has been confronted by incredibly hot, high summer temperatures. That must have accelerated a progressive attitude.
Well, look, I think you know, it's very hard to ignore now. The fact that you can get 40-degree temperatures in the United Kingdom is extraordinary. The fact that you can get 50-degree temperatures in the Arctic Circle is just mind-blowing. I mean, it's rewriting our atmospheric science textbooks. And I think that this is really this moment where we have to join the dots. I think people do understand what's going on. And really, it really is this political response that needs to be far more aggressive in terms of the way that we respond to this.
There's a lovely point you make in the book, and that is that the 50-degree day in northern Canada last year is hotter than any day recorded in Alice Springs.
Extraordinary thing to contemplate. We're talking about polar areas being desert-like heat. It is just phenomenal.
Now, you believe that we have the technical tools to respond to the crisis globally?
Yes, I do. I mean, you only have to really look at any of Ross Garnaut's books over the past decade. He must be just tearing his hair out. He's been talking about this for just such a long time. But people like Saul Griffiths are now coming forward with their ideas as well. The technology we need to turn this around already exists. And that, to me, is really the sting in the tail, because we could actually just do this. We have the technology. We're the sunniest continent on the planet, and we really can do this. And it is good to see the federal government getting behind renewable energy, but it's the opening up of fossil fuel projects that really has to stop.
Investment in renewables can see global electricity generation at 50% renewable by 2030.
Yeah, so solar power or renewable energy is cheaper over about 60% of the world than fossil fuel generated electricity. So it's already cheaper in most parts of the world to generate electricity from renewable sources.
We're talking astronomical figures, though, for investment. You cite a figure of $4 trillion.
Well, look, if you think about what got rolled out for the COVID pandemic, if we want to mobilise this kind of level of funding, we can do it. So I don't see that as a barrier. I see that as an investment in the future. I see that as averting disaster for future generations. And I also see that as a really positive moment where we finally learn to live in a sustainable way on this planet.
Denmark is an interesting case, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. Well, they had a very strong history of the exploitation of fossil fuels, and now they are the largest generator of wind energy in Europe, which is amazing. And it just goes to show that you can pivot into something new.
On this very day, one of the right-wing commentariat was celebrating a decision in the US to permit the building of mini nuclear reactors. You're shaking your head in sorrow.
Look, people just have to accept that technology, it's time to move on. We need to have low-impact technologies. So while, I mean, the argument for nuclear power has been made time and time again, it is really expensive. Renewables exist right now. We don't have to wait 10 years to build these plants.
I agree with all that. Now, one of the arguments against successfully transitioning to renewables is that developing countries don't have the resources to, well, develop renewable energy industries, a hurdle that can be overcome?
Yes, I think so. I read some really, really inspiring literature on this. There are many countries of the world, places like Morocco and Egypt and other areas where they have incredible solar potential. And really, it comes about from investing in those places to help them develop. But I think it is an extraordinary opportunity in terms of helping redistribute that sort of geopolitical power.
Do we have the physical resources to create that many solar panels?
I'd like to say that we should just at least rise to the challenge. I mean, I'm not an expert in that area, but it shouldn't let us stop us from actually trying.
We're now working on a solar plant on my farm, which will be quite large for the largest in the district, but they ain't cheap.
Yeah. Well, look, we're at the beginning of a revolutionary technology, and It's history in the making. So I think if you take the long view, that it's an investment in the future.
Okay. Now, what policies do we need to put in place here and now in Australia? Don't hold back, Joelle.
No, here and now in Australia, we have to absolutely stop opening up any more fossil fuel projects. That has to come to an end. We just have to accept that is now over. And we also need to...
Even with the enthusiasms, the new government is a bit equivocal on this.
Look, there are still over 100 different projects that are slated for fossil fuel development in this country. And as a climate scientist, I find that really, really disappointing. And it's completely inconsistent with the goals of the Paris Agreement. So we can't go down that path anymore. And our stance is really important on the international level, because we are such huge exporters of fossil fuels around the world. So that has to stop.
So it's not a matter of phasing down, but phasing out.
Phasing out. It's a matter of time. This is going to happen. It's just getting with the program and being a leader and stepping up and being that renewable energy superpower and really taking all of those opportunities on board and generating jobs and stabilising the Earth's climate. I mean, it really is a win-win.
You know, when I drive back home to the farm, I go through vast vistas of coal mines, still hammering away, endless coal trains heading down to Newcastle for export. We still find it very hard to grapple with the idea of leaving coal in the ground.
Look, it's had its time. It's been really, really important in terms of the development of human civilization. But the science is in, and we are cooking the planet. It's as simple as that. We have to stop. And so it's just coming to that realisation that we really just have to move on.
You believe we are entering a new phase of the climate change debate.
Look, I think most people do accept the science of climate change. I mean, there are some people out there who think it's all just natural variability, and that's fine. They can read my first book, Sunburnt Country, if they want to get their head around that. But honestly, we need to be moving on to the solutions. We also need to be giving the younger generations a sense of hope, a sense of feeling that there is a future worth fighting for, that there's a future that they can be a part of and that they can create, and that sustainability is not some esoteric concept. It's something we can do and something we should do within a generation in terms of transforming our planet. And so I think it is also a moral imperative to give people an opportunity to feel hopeful about the future.
When Barry Jones set up the Commission for the Future as Science Minister for Hawke, he wanted it to build a bridge between science and society at large. That bridge still needs a lot of work.
It sure does. And that's where I see the climate change issue is no longer a science issue. For me, it is a cultural issue. I think we need to stop just having conversations in our own silos, and we need to start thinking about these cultural changes, about the things that we value.
From head to heart to whole.
Exactly right.
Okay. So if the argument is no longer scientific, you believe a different set of skills are required to encourage people into taking action?
I do. I really do. Because I feel that until we have an emotional response to this, until we really feel what is at stake, that it's hard for people to be engaged or realise that it's something that's urgent and really needs attention. So, for example, if you had someone you really cared about that had cancer, wouldn't you do everything you could to try and help them? You would. You wouldn't just say, oh, well, they've got cancer, they're going to die anyway, and I'm not going to do anything about it. So effectively, the IPCC report is a global stocktake of the Earth's, the planetary health of the Earth, and really we are being faced with these really big decisions about what we want to do.
And the generational change is also incredibly important.
Absolutely.
And young people are really hot on this issue.
They really are, but they do need to find ways to be able to contribute in all sorts of different ways. So you don't necessarily have to be a climate scientist or a student activist. There's so many different things that you can do, and I think it's about telling better stories about our future and envisioning up what it is that we want to live into.
I don't want to, I'm going to be devil's advocate. Are there perhaps risks in spreading a message of hope in that it might lead to, inertia?
Now, that's a good question. Look, I don't think so, because I think that there is a misconception out there that some people think that we're experiencing runaway climate change, we're all doomed, there's going to be a cascade of tipping points and so on and so forth. So I wrote that book to give people a really solid grounding in evidence-based hope. So I've given people the scientific outline of what's going on, and then I've gone through and thought about all the different ways that other people have thought about before. Some of these ideas are not necessarily my own or new to me. I read a lot of really inspiring books and literature around this, but it really is this moment that I think does transcend our era in a sense, because it's part of the human condition. It's part of the human story. As I said, these social movements that really do change our world come about from enough people waking up, creating that critical mass, and then saying enough is enough and we're going to create a new world.
There's another term you deploy, active hope.
Yeah, that was first coined, I think, by Joanna Macy, who's a psychologist. And it is this concept that hope is not just something you feel. It is an action. It is an active thing that you do. And so for me, for example, I actively do what I can to communicate climate science to people, and that makes me feel like I'm doing what I can. But if you just sit there and you don't do anything, then that is a passive state that I think people feel, a sense of paralysis.
My favourite aphorism has always been something that Pablo Casals said on one of his, I think it was his 80th birthday, only a young bloke at the time. And he was talking about the terrible situation the world was in Spain. And then he stopped and there was a silence and he said two sentences, which in a sense don't seem to fit and yet fit perfectly. He said, "The situation is hopeless. We must take the next step." That's a form of active hope.
Spot on.
So what makes you believe that we'll find that active hope and stabilise climate through sacrifice and action?
Look, as I said, I think human history is just full of examples of moments where we've risen to the challenge. I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. I want to be clear about that. And it's clear in my book that there are some very, very dire situations that are unfolding right now. But how bad we let things get is still very much in our hands.
Look, finally, if by some miracle, some silver bullet, some technical magic, we were able to stop the emission of greenhouse gases tomorrow, how would the planet respond? Would it heal itself in the sense of Gaia?
Yeah, that's another really good question. So there have been modelling studies that show that basically once you start to stabilise emissions, the temperature stabilises as well, which is really good news. So you don't get runaway climate change, it actually adapts. That is a really important result. And as a result, we would start to see ecosystems start to recover because they won't be under intense heat stress. But it's going to require active conservation. And so we can't just expect all this is going to play out on its own. We do need to protect ecosystems and put measures in place to really do our best to give nature a fighting chance.
Earlier in the year, I spoke to three young climate activists from around the world about their activism. What do you say to many of the young people who are suffering from profound anxiety?
Hang in there. Hang in there. You're on the right side of history. The rest of the population will eventually have to catch up with you. You know, we are living through this really historic moment in human history. You're not alone. There are many, many climate scientists from all over the world who are right there behind you, and we're not going to leave you to clean up this mess alone.
I've been talking to Dr. Joelle Gergis, climate scientist and writer at the ANU, lead author for the IPCC's sixth assessment report, author of Humanity's Moment, a climate scientist's case for hope, published by Black Ink. Now, you mentioned the perils of the koala. This program has an award it gives to guests who are working above and beyond the call of duty. It's called the Koala Stamp, and you've just got one with gum leaf clusters.
Oh, I'm honoured.
Thanks for coming in. And in the week where we said goodbye to Gorbachev, it's time for me to thank the comrades here at Lenin L. Team leader Anna Whitfeld, Catherine Zengerer, Anne Arnold, Taryn Priadko, Sasha Fegan, and sound engineer Simon Branthwaite. See you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.